Economics 101. Class is in session.
In 1930, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, in an effort to alleviate the effects of the... Anyone? The Great Depression, passed the... Anyone? The Hawley-Smoot Tariff Act, which... Anyone?
In times of economic woe, does it take special financial expertise to feel the pain? How about to find your way out of debt or unemployment or poverty? Anyone? Improving your economic IQ with Freakonomist Stephen Dubner on Anyone? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's July 22nd, Tuesday, and that wasn't just to anyone. That was my talented co-host, John Hockenberry.
Anyone?
We are going to address, though, what we don't know about our financial lives. Is that hurting us? Also, high energy prices have companies looking for natural gas in pristine places. The Big Mac turns 40 years old, and the global food crisis. We'll talk about solutions with the former president of Ireland, Mary Robinson. That at Story and all the news. One of the world's most wanted fugitives has been captured. Former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic has been arrested after 12 years on the run. Karadzic has already been indicted twice on charges of genocide and war crimes by UN tribunals. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says it's good the Serbians captured him themselves.
I think it will help to bring Serbia out of kind of isolated pariah status and allow it to move forward in being a part of Europe.
His arrest came just before today's meeting of European foreign ministers. Karadzic's arrest has been one of the EU's conditions for Serbia's membership. And a setback for prosecutors at Guantanamo Bay certainly looks like one. A judge has ruled that statements made by a former driver for Osama bin Laden, Salim Hamdan, made under highly coercive conditions, he says, are not admissible. Hamdan faces a maximum life sentence if convicted of conspiracy and aiding terrorism.
Diplomats say talks between Zimbabwe's ruling and opposition parties will soon get underway in South Africa. Robert Mugabe says they won't include U.S. or U.N. influence. They have 2 weeks to set up a power-sharing deal. FDA investigators think they have finally tracked down the culprit in the cause of a recent salmonella outbreak, a single jalapeno pepper. Investigators still have to confirm that suspect.
National Guard troops are standing by in coastal Texas, where people are waiting to see whether Tropical Storm Dolly becomes a hurricane. In politics, Barack Obama has arrived in Jordan to meet with King Abdullah. John McCain holds a town meeting in Rochester, New Hampshire.
Oil's trading just below $131 a barrel in Asian trading. The markets are poised to open lower based on some bad news from the financial sector. The takeaway question this morning is, what is your economic ignorance factor? What would you like to learn more about? How did you end your economic ignorance as you face personal financial woes? Any stories? You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Do you know how to compound interest?
Yeah, I do. The question is, did you learn anything in high school about how to balance your checkbook or not? Tell us, or did you learn later the hard way?
Also,
877-8-MY-TAKE.
One other thing, people are rethinking their relationship with the land in these high energy times. Call us.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. An arrest in a shadowy neighborhood of Belgrade and on the streets of Sarajevo, jubilation.
I don't think there is a jubilation, but there is some relief because they have waited too long, which was a disgrace for the international community, for the world justice, and of course for Serbia.
Call it jubilation or call it relief, whatever you call it, one of the world's greatest war criminals and most wanted men is in the custody of the UN War Crimes Tribunal after 13 years on the run. Former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic has twice been indicted by the UN War Crimes Tribunal. He's accused of 16 counts of genocide. Joining us is BBC producer with the World Service Serbian section, is Slobodan Topovic. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks. Good morning from London.
Good morning from London. As far as you can tell, how did this arrest take place?
Well, some details just appeared during the press conference given by the chief prosecutor of the Serbian court for war crimes. According to them, Mr. Karadzic, believe it or not, spent a number of years working as a physician, as a doctor in Belgrade under false identity. He grew up a very long gray beard and dyed his hair, and no one knows he obtained false IDs as well, so he walked around just like a free man. No one knows about that till officially yesterday evening when he was arrested on the bus.
But what led to that arrest?
Well, you know, there is an obligation side of the Serbian government to fully cooperate with the Hague Tribunal, former Yugoslavia, and one very important carrot, especially for the newly formed pro-European government in Belgrade, is the possibility of European membership in the European Union. So that's a sort of a precondition. Karadzic and his wartime general, General Mladic, have to be arrested and transferred to the Hague Tribunal as a sort of precondition for Serbia's accession towards Europe. So newly pro-European government did some changes, especially in the secret services in the state and the military secret services, and definitely they did something they should have done a long time ago.
Well, Slobodan, we heard on the streets of Sarajevo, where Radovan Karadzic committed or is alleged to have committed many of his war crimes, a sense of relief and celebration because of this arrest. Is that the same throughout former Yugoslavia?
Well, I can speak only for Serbia itself. I think that is sort of a relief in Serbia amongst the large number of people who just think that with Karadzic and possibly and probably Mladic's arrest, the page in their very nasty history, very troublesome history, will be definitely closed. There were some very small demonstrations yesterday evening when the news about Karadzic's arrest was firstly announced. But the numbers were very small. People saying that there are more onlookers and police and journalists around than the participants in those demonstrations. Probably hardcore nationalists were there, but nothing substantial. We are just waiting for parties, political parties in Serbia, just to hear their reactions. We can tell with certainty that pro-European government and the parties which are in the government will, of course, welcome that event as a sort of a step forward towards the European integration. Quite interesting is that one member of that newly formed coalition is the Socialist Party, former president, Serbia president, and Hague identity, late Slobodan Milosevic. And the leader of that party is the Minister of Police, and the police, the Ministry of Interior in Serbia, published a statement saying that they were not involved in the arrest of Mr. Karadzic.
That's interesting. You mentioned Slobodan Milosevic, of course, the defendant at the last very high-profile trial at The Hague on war crimes. It was dragged out for a long period of time. It was, in some sense, a comedic show trial that Milosevic appeared to have taken control of in his own defense. Are people in Serbia worried that this could be the same kind of show trial with limited results?
You know, but people in Serbia have a sort of a very formed opinion about the Hague Tribunal, especially after two very prominent cases. This is Mr. Oric, the defender, the Bosnian army commander of the defense forces in Srebrenica, and Mr. Ramush Haradinaj, former Kosovo prime minister and Kosovo Liberation Army commander during the war in Kosovo. Those two gentlemen were freed by the court in Hague. So Serbs are mainly in largely firm in their opinion that that Hague Tribunal is definitely and utterly anti-Serbian. Hmm. On the other hand, they're well aware that without the cooperation with the Hague Tribunal, the chances for Serbia to reach European Union as their utmost target were minimal.
Right.
So I think it's just a sort of a rational compromise with our conscience. They say, okay, we are against that court. We don't treat the court as a fair one, but We need a better future for us and for our kids. So if that's the price we have to pay, we are going to pay it.
And at the very least, it seems as though Radovan Karadzic is on his own on this one, with all the incentives moving towards cooperation with the International Tribunal in The Hague. Slobodan Topovic, BBC producer with the World Service Serbian section, thanks for joining us from London. And of course, the big headline from this story is in Khartoum, where the Sudanese president Bashir, who was indicted by the War Crimes Tribunal, is probably looking at this very, very closely. Time is not necessarily on the side of War Crimes Tribunal fugitives. But meanwhile, we shift to South Asia, where the debate is fierce, the vote is tight, and the stakes are high as the Indian parliament votes on a landmark bill. Ever since India and Pakistan became nuclear combatants across a very, very tight conflict zone, the race was on in the West to find a way of defusing that nuclear confrontation zone. And a cooperation agreement was signed in 2005 between Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh and President George W. Bush. But something that's so important for world peace has been anything but peaceful in the Indian legislature. Sanjoy Majumdar, a BBC correspondent in Delhi, joins us now. The Indian parliament is getting ready to vote on this nuclear cooperation deal that would trade inspection on the part of U.S. inspectors of nuclear facilities in India for cooperation and access to U.S. fuel and technology imports. Why is this producing so much discord in the Indian parliament?
Well, it's precisely because of the people involved, which is the American administration. There are many here, particularly communist parties, left-wing parties, socialist parties, who are worried that by going ahead with this deal, it'll mean that India will become, in some ways, a much stronger ally of Washington. It'll mean that Washington will, in some ways, dictate Indian foreign policy. And in effect, they don't want India to become such a very close partner of a country that they believe or which has policies that they oppose across the world, whether it's Iraq, whether it's Afghanistan. And it really boils down to that, the fact that this will bring India, this will bring Delhi and Washington that much closer. That's making it harder for a lot of people to support.
So essentially it's a national identity issue that's potentially threatening the ruling party at this point?
Yes, at least it certainly was that way when this debate started. We've got to this position mainly because communists and left parties, which propped up this government, supported it in parliament, pulled out over differences because of the deal. They didn't want the government to go ahead and sign the deal. Since then, however, it's looking more and more like a campaign speech. We are just a little over a year away from a national election here. They're due to be held sometime in the middle of next year. They could, of course, be held earlier if the government were to fall. And so increasingly, many MPs, many lawmakers and parties are looking ahead at those elections and trying to figure out whether supporting the government over this bill or opposing it would actually get them re-elected. And perhaps that's the way. That's what will determine how they vote.
And you've got people coming to blows, literally, in the parliament, and MPs certainly arguing about this at the highest level of passion and stridence. I guess my question for you, Sanjoy, in conclusion here is there a real debate on the value of economic cooperation in the nuclear sphere versus, as Adora says, this nuclear nationalism where India's national identity is bound up in the plutonium and uranium in warheads aimed at Pakistan?
Well, I'll put it very simply. One of the MPs, when he was interviewed, said, the reason I'm voting against the deal is because I don't understand it. And if I don't understand it, how do the people of India understand it? And I think basically the issue is so complicated and so complex that, A, many people believe that many ordinary Indians don't really care about this deal. They're more interested in the price of oil, for instance, or how expensive living standards have become. And the second, of course, is that the mechanics of the deal may just mean that, you know, India may not actually get any much further than they have economically, because nuclear energy is such a small percentage of India's energy bucket that it's not going to make much of a difference.
Quickly, Sanjoy, it seems as though this is a real failure of the Bush administration to sell this deal. Yes or no?
Yes, I think it's a failure of both administrations because they haven't really made the deal understood simply in terms of what it means for you and me.
Too complicated, but certainly very important in this most complicated of conflict zones. Sanjoy Majumdar, I have to leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sanjoy Majumdar is a BBC correspondent in Delhi.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, and it's July 22nd, and we're asking, if you could write a theme song for the Big Mac, what would it be? It turns 40 today. We want to hear your song, as many, many Americans have already sent theirs to McDonald's. You can give us a call at 877-8-MYTAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we're also asking you about your economic literacy. And John, do you have an annual percentage rate in your life?
I have many annual percentage rates in my life, sadly, yes.
How about a little compound interest?
I know how to do compounding. I actually learned how to do compounding on my calculator when I was in college. But in general, I think I was completely financially ignorant until I found Quicken, the old financial
software,
yeah.
Stephen Dubner, how about you? APR in your life?
Yeah, I got it. Although I'm proud to say I've never actually owned a credit card, only a charge card, American Express. I don't mean to make it an advertisement, but I think the single...
Are you showing off that you know the difference between charge cards and credit card? This is our contributor, Freakonomics author.
Not a financial
Stephen Dubner
contributor,
is
like
joining us to look at our financial literacy, which sounds like a very fancy word for basically dealing with debt, financing, inflation, and how to cope with the stock market. And some say we're not doing such a great job. In fact, we're hurting ourselves. What's the problem, Stephen?
We are, we're a great country, right?
Yes.
We all agree with that? But we're bad at some things that we should be better at, a lot better at. For a country that is so rich, as a whole, we are financially illiterate, badly. So, and we're only just finding this out now. There's a professor of economics at Dartmouth named Anna Maria Lusardi, who, in collaboration with another economist named Olivia Mitchell, did something really sneaky and wise, which is they inserted a bunch of financial literacy questions on a bunch of national polls, surveys that the government does on all different kinds of subjects, health, retirement, drug use, all this stuff, and they stuck a few financial literacy questions in there.
Like what?
If you have $100 in the bank and you're getting 1% interest and inflation is rising, the inflation rate is 2% a year. Mm-hmm. At the end of a year, can you buy more or less?
Less.
Anyone?
Okay. That would be a less, because 2 minus 1 equal 1, so you're down 1%.
That's good. Or very simple compounding interest questions, very simple risk diversification investing questions. The bad news is that people fail miserably. The worst news is that older people fail even worse than younger people, and low education, African-American minorities, and Hispanics and women fail even worse. The slightly better news is that there's more economic education in the schools these days than there was 30 years ago. But the worst news is it's not working very well.
Let's get back to the worst news of all of us who are not doing so well in that. How does that play itself out in everyday life?
Okay. The most basic example is this. If you have a credit card and you use it, do you know what interest rate you're paying on it? And when you pay your bill every month or whenever, how much of it do you pay? If you pay what's called the minimum required payment, I hate to say it, I hope you're not sponsored by credit card companies, it is the biggest sucker bet going, because all you're doing is borrowing money at a very expensive rate, using it to buy stuff you may not need, and accruing more and more debt.
And you don't have a credit card.
Well,
ever, so
it's not about...
call you debt-free Dubner.
You can call me... No, because I have debt that I have the debt that I want. I have a mortgage, which is, some people would argue an unbelievable racket, that I have a mortgage to buy a home. One of the reasons why housing prices have risen so much in this country over the past 50, 80 years is because there's this unbelievable tax deduction for homeownership,
right?
So you take advantage of the debt that's good for you, but you don't get into the debt that's bad for you.
Let's back away from this great country of economic illiterates. Who does this well? I mean, you're not going to say, like, you know, the Israelis are good at money or something, like, you know, anti-Semitic like that. I mean, are there people who do financial stuff well?
You know, that's a good question. It's a question I asked Professor Lusardi when I wrote about this subject. And she said that, again, it's very hard to measure because we haven't really concentrated on this question much. Let me just back up 1 second. When you want to drive in this country, you got to get a license, right?
Right.
You want to buy a house? You want to raise children even. But in terms of financial, you can do anything. You can get credit cards. You can get more. Look, the subprime mess that we're in right now and the consumer debt mess that's kind of right around the corner are largely, I won't say entirely, but largely a result of people making very bad decisions, not even knowing they're making bad decisions.
No front end kind of education required to getting involved.
Is that the answer?
Well, you know, you would like to say yes, but as I mentioned before, the National Council of Economic Education, for instance, has been pushing for more teaching of this sort in the schools. They've gotten more, but the tests, the results among high school students are no better, still about half.
What's the resistance, though? I mean, we take economics, we read about all kinds.
Well, if you take economics, you probably don't have a resistance. The problem honestly, here's what I think.
But economics is not necessarily the same as basic personal finance.
No, it's not. But they do run in parallel tracks. Here's what I think is part of the problem. We do have in this country a little bit of a pride, a perverse pride in mathematical illiteracy. A lot of people love to throw up their hands and say, oh, geez, math, you know, not interested. You know, Flaubert, great. Politics, I'm interested. Math, uh-uh. And
it's okay, and we condone that. We're going to ask you to stick with us for a little while. Right now, we're going to turn to Femi Oke because she's got the latest headlines for us from the last hour. Femi?
Hello there. 28 minutes past the hour. The judge at Salim Hamdan's war crimes trial at Guantanamo Bay has barred some evidence, saying it was obtained under, and I quote, highly coercive conditions. Serbian security forces have captured Radovan Karadzic, the Serbian leader accused of orchestrating mass killings of Bosnian Muslims in the 1990s. Barack Obama is meeting with Sunni tribal leaders in Iraq, then heads to Jordan for talks with King Abdullah. And megachurch pastor Rick Warren says he will question both presidential candidates, Barack Obama and John McCain, at a forum on August the 16th. I want to revisit a story that broke yesterday about the ruling party in Zimbabwe and the opposition party agreeing to talks. I have to play you this clip for Morgan Tsvangirai. He's the head of the Movement for Democratic Change, the opposition party in Zimbabwe. He's talking with great enthusiasm about President Mugabe.
The last time I had a tit-a-tat discussion with Comrade Mugabe was in 1998. They pushed it a little bit further. So you can all imagine what an occasion it is for the leader of the ruling party and the leader of the winning party to be sitting to discuss about something.
Well, there's a change in tone.
Comrade, he called him Comrade Mugabe.
There was laughter.
Yeah.
Same phrase as President Mugabe. It just stood out to me as a piece of sound. Like, this feels a little different.
Positive omen after these talks.
After months of violence and clashes and voting and
the opposition leader
international intervention.
Yeah. It's good to hear some laughter.
Yeah, and they'll be talking on Thursday.
Absolutely, this week.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Father's Day, a short film about a woman whose father left her when she was a child, and her daughter, who now wants to meet her estranged grandfather, if he lives long enough. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adoree Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. And you can join our conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We were just talking about economic illiteracy with Stephen Dubner of Freakonomics, who's still with us. Tell us your story of how you reduced your economic illiteracy, or what aspect of economic illiteracy you would like to reduce. Also, if you really want to win the Lexus this morning, come up with a new jingle for the Big Mac, which turns 40. We're going to be talking about some contestants who are trying to write a new jingle for it, you know, two all beef patties, special sauce, da-da-da-da-da, you know. And we already have a bunch of negative ones, like the Big Mac will kill you. In any case, we want to shift gears this morning. We are taking a periodic look around the nation to what kinds of sort of thought experiments, what sort of twisted rethinking is taking place in the environment where oil is at $140 a barrel or $130 a barrel. And it's certainly changing the way people look at their land. In the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York, the energy crisis for those residents has those officials and citizens in this pristine sort of New York bedroom wilderness looking at a wealth of natural gas that may not lie beneath the wilderness of the Catskills. Joining us to discuss the community's rethinking and the possible process whereby this landscape might be transformed is Ilya Maritz, who's a reporter here at WNYC Radio. Thank you for joining us, Ilya.
Hey, John.
And Abram Lustgarten, who's a reporter for ProPublica,
ProPublica,
a nonprofit investigative news organization. Abram, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, what have you guys discovered in the Catskills that really is unprecedented for this community, thinking about itself as a natural gas source? I mean, Qatar is a natural gas source, but not the Catskills. Ilya?
What we found is that people are leasing their land for very serious money. It's interesting. I went out and I talked with a bunch of folks whose dads or maybe even whose grandfathers had experienced wildcatting. So they'd sign a lease, back in the 1940s, and nothing would ever happen. It wouldn't be worth that much, but it would be a little extra money at Christmas or something like that. Now those people are signing leases for really big amounts of money.
How much?
Well, I guess when this whole craze started, we were talking like $25 an acre. That's about $2,500 an acre now. So you're talking, if you have a 200-acre farm, you can make a ton of money.
And the industry interests who are buying these leases are saying, really, that they're doing the community a favor. Listen.
I can't think of any other example where an industry is willing to come into New York State and spend that kind of money developing local resources without asking for a handout. They're asking for a regulatory environment that makes it work.
Abram, who's speaking and what are they talking about there? That's energy industry lobbyist Tom West, who's talking about companies making investments in the actual community. What are the incentives that are really pushing citizens to offer these leases, to sell leases of their own land?
Well, much of the potential drilling that could happen is upstate in veritably poor areas, some of the poorest parts of New York State. And there's no doubt that the economic benefit that could come in from gas drilling or any kind of energy exploration is extremely attractive to some of these people, so attractive that it overwhelms environmental concerns or any other political concerns that might surround the
project. Everybody wins, right, guys? Right?
Well, not absolutely 100% exactly. When I started covering this story in the springtime, what was just interesting to me is, they think that upstate New York and parts of Pennsylvania could become the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. Isn't that funny? But what we learned in doing our reporting, Abram and I, is that when something like this happens, you have a really big, incredibly profitable industry that is in command of all the facts that it needs moving into a state where they're not used to it. Uh-huh. So even though New York State, for example, has about 13,000 active gas wells, which I think most New Yorkers don't know, they're all the way in the western part of the state, most of them, and they're conventional wells. Well, these wells that they'd be drilling in the Catskills and in parts of Pennsylvania are unconventional wells. They require about 6 million gallons of water per well. That's a ton of water
to actually do the drilling
that you're contaminating in the process of doing the drilling. You have to think about where it's going to come from, where it's going to go, how you're going to treat it. So these are all things that we are finding that that government is having to scramble to figure out.
It's a kind of an energy illiteracy that puts the communities at a disadvantage. Where in the United States has this happened where there have been consequences that maybe people in the Catskills need to pay attention to? Abram?
Well, there's been substantial drilling across Texas and New Mexico and Wyoming and Colorado for a number of years, starting in the late 1990s. And they're starting to see now that there are substantial impacts on the environment. And I don't think that in many of these states, with the exception of Texas, where drilling is happening almost in the city of Fort Worth, that there had been close attention paid to the original impacts because these are very remote rural areas. But now they're starting to see, in one case at least, an impact to an underground water aquifer, and in many cases, impacts to people's groundwater wells and drinking water supplies.
And actually, people from the West and some of the experiences that you describe have interacted with community members in the Catskills to tell their story, I suspect, to at least provide a cautionary tale for people as they proceed. Here's one such voice.
And this blowout released several hundred tons of toxic chemicals that were used in the hydraulic fracturing, this was the drilling and production drilling process where the well blew out, lost circulation, and they had to evacuate people in the community for, I think it was about 3 days.
Ilya, you actually attended this meeting where this Wyoming resident, Jill Morrison, talked to a crowd in Walton, New York.
Yeah, this was kind of incredible. You had three people from Western states with firsthand experience of gas drilling flown in, on a shoestring to talk to this community.
By whom?
It was by Catskill Mountain Keeper, which is a local group.
An advocacy
group. Unashamedly a group that is skeptical of drilling. But they wanted to know, okay, it's happened in these places. What can we learn from the example? So Jill Morrison is a resident of the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, where there's a ton of gas drilling. She was talking about an instance where when a well is drilled, and Abram might know better than me, you often flare it at the beginning when it's burning off some of that initial rush of gas. Well, that can be really, really toxic. And I think particularly out in a place like Wyoming, maybe they thought, oh, not so many people around. Well, a lot of people are downwind of that. They found that there were a lot of nuisances associated with the drilling that you had to anticipate.
Let me ask this quickly. In terms of learning from other places where this drilling has taken place and some of the potential problems associated now, is that information accessible? Is that something that is easily passed on to the communities in upstate New York as they move forward in trying to decide whether they want that to happen in their communities?
I think, like many things, it's accessible if you search it out. If you're diligent and you go and you Google for a couple hours and you look at what the environmental agencies, the EPA, and the state regulatory agencies in these states have available, there's a wealth of information available from toxicology test results to people's testimonies.
But certainly, I think the questions that are going to be asked and the debates that these communities are going to be getting into represent a real sea change in the politics in an environment where there's, $130 a barrel oil, and also potentially the way these communities are going to look if the drilling actually takes place. Thanks so much for finding the details of the story. Ilya Meretz is a WNYC reporter. Abram Lustgarten is a reporter for ProPublica, looking at the Catskill Mountains, considering themselves as a natural gas resource in this energy environment. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. It's Tuesday, July 22nd, and this is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. A certain burger, Stephen, come on, anyone, turns 40 years old this year. Here's a clue. All-beef patties. It's the one. The Big Mac, the recipe for which is two all-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun. And to celebrate the 40th birthday, the company asked people to submit their versions of that 1975 jingle to MySpace.
And they'll be announcing the winner of the contest today. Today, the winner will be known. As an example, here's just one of the finalists.
You like that one? Kind of Latin feel. It is one of the finalists, but there's a lot of different versions of this song that were submitted. This one is from a teenager. His name is Chris Puth. I want
two while we pay special sauce, let's
yeah, I'll take one of those.
I think we call that easy listening.
Can I have a shake too?
That would be one of the calmer versions. Some of the other songs are, well, I'll just let you judge. Let's listen. So the child laughing in the background, not really sure what that has to do.
Yeah, we don't know. It's
laughing,
a kind of a mixed
crying
signal
in the background, not sure what that has to do with McDonald's. But most of the songs actually fell into a category that sounds a bit like this. Big Mac, this is how it comes. Two all beef patties
with a special sauce. Cheese, pickles, lettuce, onions on the sesame seed. Give me two.
Sounding a little bit like Cameo circa 1990s.
You know, Dora, I don't know if that song is about food, actually, really. I don't know.
We're trying to make the point that the bulk of the versions that people submitted were of the hip-hop variety, and that one was a Miami finalist. That was a Tamian Bane. At least that was the first
one. Can we just
one.
Applaud McDonald's for a minute
Skits.
For getting the world
the
to do their marketing for him? It's fantastic.
That's right. Oh, you know, this guy, Tamian Bane, who wrote this song.
But this is priceless.
Yeah, he actually once robbed a McDonald's at gunpoint when he was 14
so
years
he knows,
old.
So right, he knows, right?
According to the Associated Press, yeah. We might add.
But there's history here, okay? All of these would-be jingle composers are following in the footsteps of this Broadway musical. Anyone? Anyone? One singular sensation. That's right.
Chorus line.
Excellent.
And let me explain this link here, a chorus line. One of the creators of that singular sensation song, Kevin Reinhardt, said that at the time his ad agency wanted to use a parody of the Broadway tune, but instead, out of exasperation, his partner played his guitar and angrily sang the ingredients, and boy, there you had it.
Wow. Was he paid by the sesame seed lobby, I wonder?
I wonder. It's all part of the history. And today, McDonald's will announce the winner of the contest. The winner will get a trip to L.A. They'll have their song used in an upcoming commercial, but no money prize, just immortality. And we all hope the winner is loving that. Happy birthday, McDonald's. Big Mac, 40 years old today. I mean, I think if I was going to do the lyrics, it might be a little more cautionary. Don't eat too many. They might kill you.
Or not.
Remember that movie,
Fast
Food
Nation. Maybe it's
not
the Big Mac. Maybe it's the French fries.
Yeah, and we should note, McDonald's is not a sponsor of this program, The Takeaway, actually.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 22nd, and we have the latest headlines for you from Femi Okay. Good morning, Femi.
Hello there. 12 minutes to the hour. A judge has ordered ex-Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic's transfer to a UN war crimes tribunal in The Hague. Barack Obama raised $52 million in June. A record-breaking $30 million came from small donors. Private security firm Blackwater Worldwide says it's shifting focus away from private security contracts to focus on other military work. Apple shares have dropped despite strong iPhone sales. And a federal appeals court has thrown out an indecency fine against CBS for the 2004 Super Bowl halftime show, and I quote, wardrobe malfunction.
Oh, America's long national nightmare is over.
But we had a whole new phrase thanks to the federal appeals court there. And that's a look at your news, domestic and international.
Thank you, Femi. We've already had a response to our suggestion that someone rewrite the jingle for Big Mac, which turns 40. And certainly the sentiments were not in keeping with our segment a moment ago. Here's from our friend Jack the Martini Cowboy.
Hello, my friends of The Takeaway. It's your old friend Jack Grace the Martini Cowboy. I thought I'd just call in my little song for the McDonald's folks that goes like this. Two old fat ladies raised on grease that ain't natural with toys for the kids. You hook them young. I hope you enjoy them. Have a good day.
Hook them young. I think that's the takeaway
there. Thank you, Jack Grace. Yes, 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can join the conversation on anything in the program. And we're going to shift gears and talk about real food crises.
Real food crisis, because there's just essentially no let-up on the global food crisis. Drought, high oil prices, conflict. A confluence of events continues to create ever-escalating tensions. We're talking fatal clashes, rationing, talks about food price controls. Joining us to dissect the issues is Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland and the former UN High Commissioner of Human Rights, who's just returned from South Africa, where she was celebrating Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday. Welcome,
thank
President
you.
Robinson. It's very nice to have you here this afternoon. How was the birthday party?
It was great. We were there for a meeting of the elders, which is a group that Nelson Mandela and his wife, Graça Machel, have brought together. Our chair is Archbishop Tutu, Kofi Annan's a member, and Jimmy Carter from this country.
Oh, nice company.
Yeah. And we had a lunch with Nelson Mandela, Madiba, as we call him. And it was really wonderful because he was in such good form. Mm. He really enjoyed it. And we had a very interesting conversation. And one of the things that he was asked about, I don't know if you know this word, Ubuntu, the African concept, what he thought about it. And he sort of said, well, you know, there's nothing new in it. It's about humanity. It's about the fact that we're all linked. And it was just great to hear somebody, you know, who's valued, especially by young people all over the world, actually say something so simple and profound.
That's great. Well, you are a member of the elders. Easy for Nelson Mandela to say he's 90. But as a member of this group, you want to have particular interest and influence on the way people look at food distribution in the world. What is your goal, and what have you managed to accomplish? Certainly, things are changing underfoot very, very rapidly.
Yes, we had a public meeting in South Africa, which ActionAid helped to convene. The elders have decided to mark the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by taking month by month different values of the Universal Declaration. And one of the values, of course, is freedom from hunger, right to food. And when we decided this last December, we didn't know that during the month of July it would be so urgent. This food crisis is a crisis of the poor. It's a crisis of the poorest. The figures are shocking. Over 800 million people in this world today are hungry every day. And, of course, the majority of them are women, and it affects children. A child dies every 5 seconds from hunger or food-related causes. And the combination, it's like a perfect storm. We have rising food prices of all the foods, wheat, maize, corn, oil, that are essential to the poorest families who spend most of their income on food, what income they have. And it's high fuel prices. It's drought and flooding in agricultural producing areas, including in this country. And it's the biofuel issue, though I think that's been possibly a little bit exaggerated now.
Biofuels being competition for food source, for commodities.
Using food products. Right. And I think we're now learning that turning corn into biofuel is not a good idea. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this country has been focused on that. There are good biofuels. And then changing food habits in countries like China and India.
They're eating more meat, of course, more meat takes more resources.
And then you're getting a
produce.
Bit of speculation, a bit of hoarding and speculation, right. Which is very worrying.
So how do you think that given all of these things, and we've reported on many of them on this show, how should we be looking at what really matters? Obviously, feeding people is important. No one's going to argue that point. Is it a problem with getting the food to people? Is it a problem of the priorities of the developing countries? Are they giving the money that's needed in order to execute those plans to feed? Is it a question of conflict? We talked about Somalia yesterday and this systematic targeting of aid workers who caught up in the middle of fighting between the secular government and Islamic parties.
All of those are relevant issues, but I think the main failure is a policy failure, a failure in poor countries, and I would particularly focus on Africa, to have a policy of food security grown locally, proper agricultural policy.
But there's limits to what one country can do. I want to bring Steve Dubner in on that. I mean, it seems to me that as these prices rise, the one thing that is not having an impact is the notion that we have surpluses and that those surpluses will somehow make their way to the poorest countries. There's some blockages in the system now that individual national food crises can't really get at.
Yeah, I would love to ask two questions. One is, why has the spike in food prices taken everyone so much by surprise? Because much of what you've mentioned, some of it is drastic and unexpected, but most of it is not. And second, I'd like to know, where is Norman Borlaug in all of this? Because for years he was known as the father of the Green Revolution, who said we can feed 10 billion people. A lot of his attention was focused on South Asia and Africa. Where has that hope and that technology gone?
On your first point, the surprise, I think we did know that there were increasing problems, but the fuel surge has hit very badly. And I think what is tragic is that it's setting back these Millennium Development Goals that we've been talking about here in New York on the week of the 23rd, 24th, 25th of September. There'll be a high-level General Assembly on it, and this will be highly relevant. If you take, for example, HIV, people on antiretrovirals need nutrition. And I've been in a number of clinics. I've visited people in different countries, in Kenya, in South Africa itself, where, in fact, that's the major problem, to have the food to support the antiretrovirals. I spoke to a young girl in South Africa after the debate on the food crisis because she had taken part in an ActionAid children's demonstration. They did a wonderful profile of Nelson Mandela, which you could see from the air, several thousand children. And I talked to her. She was the eldest of six. Her mother's a domestic worker. They eat once a day now. And that's in Alexandra in South Africa. I was in Senegal recently, and there were food riots while I was there because of a lack of emphasis on small-scale agriculture. Hmm. So to your second question, we do need... The words Green Revolution worry some local, bottom-up workers because they tended to be large-scale using fertilizers that actually were the technological answer. In Africa, it has to be a labor-intensive answer, but we do need better fertilizers that are geared to smallholders. And, of course, many of the smallholders, the farmers, 60% of them in Africa are women, and they have so many burdens. But we do need to realize this is not a crisis of today or tomorrow. This is a sustained crisis over decades.
When you talk about local growing, don't you then first have to create some kind of security? Zimbabwe used to be a major exporter of products, of produce in Africa. Now, given what's been happening politically, they are importing one-third of the food that they need to feed their people.
And it's worse than that. We talked a lot about Zimbabwe. The stores are empty. There isn't food. And people are literally starving. And if it wasn't for kind of remittances and, sort of help, the aid workers have been prevented now from going in. So the political crisis in Zimbabwe is extraordinarily urgent. There are some moves. Mbeki was there yesterday with President Mugabe and Morgan Tsvangirai, at least the beginnings of talks. I have friends who are, from Zimbabwe. I was talking to one yesterday here in New York, and she is desperate. The situation is appalling. And that was a breadbasket.
Political stability, sort of food and economic stability, all these things require an increased awareness on the part of everybody inside nations and also globally. Mary Robinson, thanks so much for coming to the studio this morning to talk about this. Mary Robinson, of course, a member of the Nelson Mandela Elders, former president of Ireland, former UN High Commissioner of Human Rights. There's some Freakonomics for you, Stephen Dubner.
It makes you ask if Malthus was right, right? For years we've been saying no.
Well,
today we talked about financial literacy. We talked about the global food prices. We want to hear from
energy
you.
Energy illiteracy.
Yeah. What's your thought on how the world can deal with the food crisis and how you might want to balance your checkbook? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Here's today's takeaway.
Two old fat ladies raised on grease that ain't natural with toys for the kids. You hook 'em young.
Happy birthday, Big Mac, or not. If you missed anything on today's program, you can catch up with us on iTunes and Friend Feed.
I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. It's a Takeaway. Turns out life after hardcore prison time requires some intensive career management.
Put the bunny back in the box.
I knew you was a punk. And I was right. You've been playing us all along. You a free man.
I said, put the bunny back in the box.
He's a free man now. In the decades since the movie Con Air came out, real ex-cons down in Florida found the subprime mortgage business to be a great post-lockup career option. Homebuyer's remorse when your mortgage broker has spent time in the big house. Out-of-the-box thinking on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 22nd, and it's a true life story. Thousands of convicted criminals one day in Florida, mortgage brokers the next, an expose by the Miami Herald coming up. More news in the changing world of automotive giant. This time it's GM. Also in Zimbabwe, arch enemies sit down to talk. There's oil in South Dakota. Yep, South Dakota. And cocktails in New Orleans. That's not so surprising. That story and more coming up. One of the world's most wanted fugitives has been captured. Former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic was captured after 12 years on the run. Former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Richard Holbrooke had this to say.
This is a great day. A major, major thug has been removed from the public scene.
Karadzic is accused of orchestrating mass killings, including the massacre of at least 7,500 Muslims in July 1995. A judge has ordered his extradition to The Hague. He already has been indicted twice by the UN War Crimes Tribunal. It's a setback for prosecutors at Guantanamo. A judge has ruled that statements made by a former driver for Osama bin Laden, Salim Hamdan, were made under highly coercive conditions, and they are not admissible. Hamdan faces a maximum life sentence if convicted of conspiracy and aiding terrorism.
Diplomats say talks between Zimbabwe's ruling and opposition parties will soon get underway in South Africa. President Robert Mugabe says they won't include U.S. or U.N. perspectives.
We shall be doing this as Zimbabweans, entirely as Zimbabweans.
The talks aim to set up a power-sharing deal aimed at ending the country's political crisis. FDA investigators think they finally have a culprit. Tracing the cause of a recent salmonella outbreak, jalapeno peppers. It's not confirmed, but that's the latest suspect. A hurricane warning is in effect for parts of Texas and the Mexico coast. Tropical storm Dolly expects to make landfall late tonight or early tomorrow.
Oil's trading just below $131 a barrel in Asian trading. The Dow closed flat at 11,467, and the S&P opens at 1260 today.
We asked earlier in the morning that, Big Mac turns 40. Could you actually come up with a new theme for the Big Mac? People actually took up the challenge, and we have some to play for you. But we also want to learn from you how you learned how to be economically literate, if you are, in fact, economically
literate. Right. Is your checkbook balanced?
Do you know how to compound interest? What's a story of economic literacy you can tell? Or what economic illiteracy would you love to eliminate as you face these difficult
economic
times?
And on that Big Mac theme song, John, I would encourage people to include calorie and fat count.
Yes.
8778-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today in Zimbabwe, John, there are many, many people hoping that perhaps today is a new day. This after Robert Mugabe signed an agreement with his bitter rival, opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai, to agree to formal talks, perhaps leading to some kind of power-sharing arrangement. This after 3 months of violence and defiance against the opposition as Zimbabwe made its way through presidential elections. Joining us now for more is Jonah Fisher, BBC correspondent, who's coming to us from Johannesburg. And Jonah, lay out these formal talks for us, and is it believed that there is true substance to Robert Mugabe's claim that he will engage and participate in those discussions?
Well, what we saw yesterday in Harare was the signing of a memorandum of understanding between the opposition MDC, two factions from that group, and ZANU-PF, Robert Mugabe's party. They sat down. It was the first time the leaders of ZANU-PF and the MDC had actually met each other for the last 10 years. So in itself, it was quite a historic and quite a symbolic moment when those two men sat down, held a press conference, and then rather reluctantly shook hands. happens at the end. But in itself, the agreement that they signed is basically just a commitment to hold talks, that they've not actually agreed anything in terms of how a future government in Zimbabwe will be made up, how the MDC, the opposition, will work with ZANU-PF, that the ruling party, and crucially, and this is what really the talks will hinge on, what role Robert Mugabe, who's been in charge of Zimbabwe since it was first made independent in 1980, what role he will play. Will he stay on as president, or perhaps will some way
Jonah,
be found
before we
to
even
give him
get
a dignified
to all
exit?
Of those, Jonah, before you even get to all of those very important questions, what brought him to that meeting yesterday? What pressure did he believe that he was facing? Because this is a man who has been defiant for weeks and months on end.
Well, the pressure's been building on Robert Mugabe from his fellow leaders in southern Africa. The crisis in Zimbabwe has spilt over from Zimbabwe's borders. Millions of people have been displaced into Mozambique, into Botswana, into South Africa, where I'm speaking to you from now. So there's been a lot of pressure from within the region for some sort of solution. The African Union passed a resolution saying a government of national unity had to be formed. So really it's an accumulation of pressure, and within Zimbabwe itself an acknowledgement that the economic situation there is so bleak that they simply can't carry on as they are, and some sort of accommodation will have to be made with the opposition.
Well, Jonah, something certainly is going on. We've been listening to Morgan Tsvangirai talking about his reactions to the talks, and you know, he's positively ebullient. I mean, he's laughing and joking, and it's a far cry from the tone these leaders were talking in as recently as just a couple of weeks ago.
Well, certainly the mood has changed following this meeting in Harare yesterday, and certainly Morgan Tsvangirai feels that he's making at last some progress in his ambition to take over from Robert Mugabe as president of Zimbabwe. The MDC, of course, feel like they won the election in March, the first round of the election, fair and square, and that they pulled out of the second round because the violence was so bad. So they really want to be given the key role in any future government, and I think Morgan Tsvangirai regards this process, which began yesterday, as really the first step towards that. But I think he's under no illusions that a lot of tough talking remains, and Robert Mugabe certainly on his historical record has shown no sign of wanting to leave quietly.
And I think your point was well taken a moment ago when you were talking about the economy yesterday as Mugabe was signing this accord. Zimbabwe, the government, was releasing a $100 billion note that was issued, and really would only buy you about two loaves of bread. So there's some symbolism for you. What happens now? They are slated to begin speaking on Thursday, I believe. Is the schedule laid out?
Well, the only stipulation in the memorandum of understanding which was signed is that the talks should start immediately and that the whole process should take just 2 weeks. We don't know exactly when those talks will begin. Some people are saying they may even start as early as today, but there's obviously a very tight schedule being put on things, and it's very hard to see how they can resolve so many of the complex issues, such as a new constitution,
right,
the way they're all going to work together in just 2 weeks. They put that timetable in place of 2 weeks, I think, to stress the urgency of the situation, the fact that this can't be a process that drags out for too long, because the situation in Zimbabwe at the moment is just so bleak and difficult.
A very urgent situation. Jonah Fisher, thank you.
Thank you.
Jonah Fisher reporting for the BBC, and he came to us from Johannesburg.
Well, the economy is certainly a motivator there in southern Africa as they begin talks in Zimbabwe, but it's also a motivator here on this side of the globe as the U.S. auto industry, we've reported on for the last several weeks, has been completely reexamining its business model, GM first, we reported about. But this week, Ford Motor Company is set to announce its quarterly earnings. Earnings have not been terribly good news from any of the automakers over the last several quarters, but Ford Motor Company, as it is set to announce those quarterly earnings, is also reconsidering its strategy for selling and producing cars, moving away from the standard pickup truck, which has been so successful for Ford, to maybe manufacturing more cars and different kinds of cars. Joining us now is Bill Vlasic, who's the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. Bill, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, John.
So Ford moves away from trucks. I mean, there's something almost un-American about that.
Well, Ford certainly won't abandon the pickup truck market, but they are going to make a very dramatic shift into building more small cars for the United States market, converting assembly plants, engine plants, And doing it very, very rapidly for an automaker and at great expense. I don't believe they have much choice. The pickup market and the large SUV market has fallen off a cliff this year with gas prices, and there are really no signs that it's going to ever get back to where it was during its heyday in the 90s and early this decade.
What communities can expect to see this conversion investment begin to happen? And Ford has already slashed about 40,000 jobs in the last 3 years. Are job losses also a part of this conversion, or can they keep those jobs?
Well, we don't know all the details, and Ford is also going to be extending more buyouts to its hourly workers. They have just about completed a pretty dramatic reduction in white-collar workers of 15%. But some of their big assembly plants, including one here in Michigan, which is known as Michigan Truck, which was at one point the most profitable auto plant in the world when it was building the Expedition and the Navigator in the 1990s, is going to, our understanding is going to switch over to building Ford Focuses. Quite a change.
The shift is just for now into passenger cars from trucks, but I'm wondering if there's a follow-on shift to higher technology, to more hybrids. Ford, at least in the domestic market, was a leader in bringing hybrids to market. Is that a part of the strategy?
Well, the central part of this is to bring many of their European design small cars to the United States, which are very nice vehicles, have sold well in Europe, but just weren't the kind of thing that Americans were interested in when gas prices were low. We do believe that there will be some hybrid technology possibly involved in this announcement, but they haven't really revealed all the details. Clearly, everything that Ford, General Motors, and virtually every automaker in the world is doing is moving towards more fuel efficiency in a variety of ways.
The question is, can they do it in time? There's really a race against time for a lot of these auto companies. I read last week that General Motors' capitalization on Wall Street at one point was less than Bed Bath & Beyond. I'm wondering if the stock falls so low, if Ford becomes a takeover target long before it can turn things around.
And can I just add to that, not to make it complicated, Bill, but I have a friend who's an investment banker who said essentially the auto industry is like the Titanic headed for an iceberg. Is there confidence that this conversion can be made?
Well, it seems like Ford, GM, and Chrysler have already hit a few icebergs in the last couple of years, so they're taking on water. Question is whether or not they can navigate through this and survive. The dramatic drop in GM's share price last week to below $10 a share really was a sign of a growing sense of possibility that GM could go bankrupt or the company may just falter. I think GM did some pretty dramatic things last week to save money and keep themselves liquid for another year or two.
We'll see if Ford has similar dramatic announcements, but you're right. It's bad news from all of the auto companies at this point and in this season. Bill Vlasic, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Bill Vlasic is the Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times, focusing on Ford shifting out of pickup trucks. If you own a Ford pickup, you better hold on to it. That thing's going to be a collector's item.
There are lots of people who have them, too.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 22nd, and today news on working women. Economic times may be tight, but a new congressional study to be released this morning shows regardless of race, class, or education, more and more women are bowing out of the workforce, and they are reversing a 20-year trend. For more, we turn to Louis Uchitel, who reports on labor for the New York Times. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Lou, the study is almost counterintuitive. In tough times, you'd think that more women would actually be trying to get into the workforce to help support their families, but this is not what this study finds.
Well,
that's not what this study finds. It's not what my reporting was finding as I went into this story and stumbled across this report that was about to be released. And the data shows that women piled into the labor, into work, never mind into looking for work, into jobs at in ever greater numbers every time there was a recovery. And at the end of each recovery, the percentage at work was higher. This time, for the first time, it's slightly lower. And that turns out to be, through a lot of interviewing, the result of women being treated like men. They get laid off, they get their wages cut, they get discouraged, and they drop out, as men have been doing for a long time.
And particularly, you say, just like men, women have been hit hard by a lot of manufacturing jobs that have been lost.
Well, the women joined the manufacturing assembly lines in the 70s, pretty much. That was really when the surge began, some before. And they became a very big presence in the manufacturing labor force, not only on the assembly lines, but also in office work and so forth. And as manufacturing has cut back, their huge share of that workforce has been deeply affected.
And in your reporting, you talk about how those manufacturing jobs essentially delivered pretty good wages. And when women, just like men, lose those jobs, replacing them becomes very difficult and certainly discouraging.
Yes, it is. It's a very difficult thing. Tutti Sampson, who is an example I use, who had worked at a union factory, Maytag, in Newton, Iowa, lost a job that paid her $20 an hour, not counting overtime. She sees no way to replace that unless she goes back to college, gets a bachelor's degree, and eventually works up to a good white-collar job. So she's dropped out of the workforce for more than 2 years.
Lewis, let's talk about this component of the discouraged workers as a piece of the whole economic driver here. I mean, you've got a larger and larger kind of hidden group of workers who are no longer even looking for work. The Department of Labor doesn't put them in the employment figures anymore, but they do show up in other statistics. If women are joining them, does that make it more difficult for us to come out of an economic downturn?
Well, it makes it more difficult in the sense, well, there's 2 points here. That discouraged workers survey only counts the people that say they're discouraged. There's lots and lots of women and men who don't say anything. They just say we're not working or we're going to school. They don't say we're not working because we can't get the wage we want to get. Many of them say we're not working because we don't want to work in these conditions. It gets harder to come out of a downturn because two earner families, the wife and the husband, were bringing in incomes. And when the man lost the job in bad times, the woman had went into the labor force or held a job more easily than men. And that isn't happening now.
It seems sometimes, if you read between the lines of this study, that part of what's driving this also is that the cost of services, home care services that enable two-income households to function, is maybe rising so fast that it's actually cheaper for one individual to stay out of the labor force, and that's part of what's driving this.
That's a hard one that's a hard conclusion to draw. Women have been entering the labor force for a long time. They want to work, and they're not going to be driven out of it just by the cost of a slightly higher or higher cost of home care and so forth. This is really a situation where the jobs aren't there, or the wages aren't there, or the conditions of work are not satisfactory to the women, not home care.
Hmm. Another point of the study that you report on that I found surprising is that this notion holds true regardless of race, class, or education, that it's all women who are bowing out in numbers that are showing up significantly. How do you reconcile that usually you see differences among those different categories?
Well, it surprised me, too. There are differences in levels. That is, the percentage of college-educated women is at work is higher than the percentage of high school educated, but the pattern is the same. That is, it bumped up, hit a sort of a peak in 1999 or 2000, dropped during the 2001 recession, and in every case never got back to where it was before.
How do you explain that quickly, because we have a little bit of time left? How do you explain that?
Well, I explain it because people, women are having as much trouble getting and holding jobs as men. It's a purely economic issue. It's not a question of whether your children are under six or teenagers, mm-hmm. but a question of whether you can get a job that you consider respectable.
So, Lou, are we talking about equity at last? Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, we're talking about equity.
equity in a downturn.
Right.
Equity,
wow.
I mean, women are absolutely part, an ingrained part of this workforce. And what happens to the workforce, mm-hmm. to men in the workforce, happens now to women.
Louis Uchitel, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
There may be a glass ceiling, but there's no glass floor.
Louis Uchitel, he came to us from the New York Times reporting on the Labor Department. And now we're going to turn to Femi because I know she's got some headlines for us.
Well,
Femi?
I wouldn't want to disappoint you. 28 minutes past the hour. After more than a decade on the run, accused Serbian war criminal Radovan Karadzic has been captured. Barack Obama is meeting with Sunni tribal leaders in Iraq. He headed to Jordan for talks with King Abdullah later today. The private security firm Blackwater Worldwide says it's shifting focus away from private security contracts because of negative media coverage of its work in Iraq. Now, earlier on the program, we spoke to Jonah Fisher from the BBC. He gave us the latest analysis on the Zimbabwe talks between President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. It's a plan, it's the plan to actually end the crisis over the disputed presidential election. Now, Jonah mentioned the very bleak economic situation in Zimbabwe, but let me take you back to the signing ceremony because there was some very nervous laughter. The South African President Thabo Mbeki asked one president and then he asked Morgan Tsvangirai to shake hands after they signed the agreement. So if you could be on a fly on a wall, this is what you would have heard.
Shake my hand, Morgan.
Okay, we shake hands.
We must shake my hand.
and then you'll
okay. So there's some nervous laughter there, but just let me just recap. So Mbeki said, shake my hand, Morgan. And then he said to President Mugabe, shake my hand. And so the two were being brought together for the first time. And I absolutely think it was just nervous tension and energy and nervous laughter that was around that whole situation.
And we'll see if it carries over.
Talk start Thursday.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. And, of course, you can join our conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We've been talking about economic illiteracy, how you might eliminate yours, and what stories you might tell about learning about the economy in a way that maybe helped your own personal prosperity, or economic ignorance you'd love to get rid of at a certain point. We also, it's the 40th birthday for the Big Mac, and some of you have actually sent in alternative jingles for the Big Mac to replace the one that I'm not going to sing again this hour. We're also talking about communities around the United States in an environment of $130, $140 barrel of oil are rethinking their relationship with their land. For instance, imagine you're a resident of a rural community out in the West in the Great Plains and the economy has been tough and all of a sudden somebody comes to town and says this.
This refinery is going to be the most advanced state-of-the-art facility in the United States and the world.
That's Preston Phillips, project engineer for a company called Hyperion, speaking at a public input hearing in Elk Point, South Dakota in late fall, where the people of that community are considering building a large oil refinery in their community, a community that doesn't have a lot of oil. It's a remote farming community in South Dakota, and plans are underway to make Union County, South Dakota, the home of this country's first new oil refinery in 30 years. The company behind the project promises jobs and that the refinery will be something called a green energy center. Too good to be true. Johanna Saylor, who's a news producer. Johanna Saylor, a news producer for South Dakota Public Broadcasting based in Sioux Falls, joins us now. Johanna, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
This is a radically new debate for the people of South Dakota, but it's a sign of the times, right?
It really is, and I think a lot of people here in South Dakota were a bit dumbfounded when they found out that it was going to be an oil refinery, because like you mentioned, we don't have oil in South Dakota, particularly not in eastern South Dakota. So why would they pick a rural area? And I think part of it is just that the business climate is good in South Dakota, low taxes, so it's easy for a company to come in. It's a good selling point for South Dakota. And plus, South Dakotans are always looking for economic development, particularly in rural areas.
Let's outline a couple of the details here, because this is beyond the pipe dream stage. Zoning for the project has allowed it to at least initially go forward. And secondly, where are you going to get the oil since you can't drill it out of your own ground?
Oh, sure. The rezoning of agricultural land, about 32,000 acres has been approved, or excuse me, 3,200 acres has been approved by the county commission, and also voters that went to a public vote. And so it is moving forward into the permitting stage. Now, where they plan to get the oil is up in Canadian's tar sands, and they plan to pipe it in. We don't know exactly where the pipeline would go. Those details haven't been released. They said they're still considering their options. Coincidentally, though, there is another company, TransCanada and ConocoPhillips, who are planning to build a pipeline that would run from Canada down to Texas, and it would come through South Dakota, and that would transport 1.1 million barrels per day. So that's an option, but both companies are saying, there's no real connection, but it's a possibility.
And that's really just one part of the story, the economics of it all. What is the concern of some of those in South Dakota who are not quite sure they want to have oil pipelines going through their backyard?
Well, sure. Well, of course, there's the environmental concerns. They're worried about air quality. They're worried about the water. This oil refinery probably picked this site in South Dakota because it is really close to the Missouri River. They say they need 12 million gallons of water each day to power the refinery. So that's one reason they'd be looking at it. But residents are saying, well, you know, what's that going to do to the environmental aspect of this rural community? But also quality of life is huge because you have farmers. A lot of these farmers that are in the area, They're generational. We have one fellow, his grandfather, Dale Harkness, started farming this land in the late 1800s, and he's been in this county since. And it's really great farmland, really plush, gets lots of moisture, lots of corn and soybeans come out of this area.
Well, let's hear Dale actually express those concerns in some tape of an interview that you did with him. Here's Dale Harkness talking about his concerns.
I guess the good Lord give us the opportunity to enjoy that land, this community, raise our family in this area. I don't think he gave us the opportunity to enjoy that farm so we would turn it over to be destroyed by an oil refinery. Destroying it would be a dirty shame. That's why one of the reasons we're fighting.
Wow. It's, you know, you can hear in his voice this trade-off, but it sounds, if voters have already approved the zoning, that a lot of people are willing to make this trade-off.
You know, it is, because I think that they're looking at the economic development benefits. Hyperion is promising, once built, it will provide 1,800 good-paying jobs. There's some opportunities with the public universities. The universities are excited to maybe start some new degree programs within the oil business, providing more opportunities for young people. South Dakota's had an issue in recent years of young people leaving the state to find other opportunities because the high-paying, you know, high tech jobs just aren't in the state. So there's a lot of people looking at all the benefits the refinery has, and they might not live right next to it, like Dale Harkness.
Here's a last question, and really, really quickly. We talked with people from another community early on in the morning about the issue of oil companies having a lot more expertise than the people in these communities, and that it's easy for them to maybe do something on the order of a snow job to get things fast-tracked. Do you see that going on here in South Dakota, or are people sophisticated and know what it is they're buying here?
Well, I think there is a ton of mistrust. This project started as being dubbed the Gorilla Project. Hyperion came in and they're looking for some land options. They didn't tell anybody what their project was going to be. Well, enough pressure and enough speculation and enough rural chatter brought it out that it was going to be an oil refinery. Otherwise, I don't think they would have released those details to the public so early.
Can't hide anything on the internet these days. Johanna Saylor, news producer for South Dakota Public Broadcasting, talking about a debate that is definitely going on and a sign of the economic times in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Now, headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the hour. This just in on the wires. Barack Obama has just arrived in Jordan on his 8-country tour through the Middle East. Also, just watching the radar summary for Tropical Storm Dolly. It looks like it could be a hurricane, a Category 1 hurricane, before it makes landfall in Texas in the next couple of hours. I will keep you up to date with that. Copious amounts of rainfall expecting through the southern area of Texas. The books of mortgage finance giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are being closely examined by the Federal Reserve. The judge in the trial of Osama bin Laden's driver, that's Salim Hamdan, has barred evidence that was obtained by interrogations in Afghanistan. Lawmakers in Nepal have voted in Rambaram Yadav as the country's first post-royal president, rejecting a candidate backed by the Maoists. And former Olympic gold medalist Marion Jones has asked President Bush for a pardon. Jones was sentenced to 6 months in jail for lying about her use of performance-enhancing drugs. And, of course, she had several amazing performances during previous Olympic Games. I wonder if that timing for her pardon just comes at the right time as we think about the Summer Olympic Games.
You've also been talking about Radovan Karadzic, who's in custody and is on his way to a tribunal in The Hague, the world's most wanted war criminal. That was something you were talking about earlier.
I will, and I will develop that story. I've got so many great bits of sound, and I will bring that all of that sound and the timeline together to make it all make sense.
Great.
For you.
Thank you, Fanny.
You're welcome.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
I'm parched. I am parched. Oh, well, thank you. Thank you, Adora.
I think
so
you might
nice
need a
you.
Little cranberry juice. Yeah. How about a slice of lemon? Would you like a slice of lemon, John?
Yeah, a little more vodka.
A little bit. Well, you've heard the line. It's always cocktail hours somewhere. And in New Orleans, they take that very seriously because cocktail hours are many hours of the day. And it's why it's fitting, perhaps, that a museum is opening there. Dr. Cocktail Ted Hay joins us now to talk about this cocktail museum that is opening this week. First, tell me, though, how'd you get that name, Dr. Cocktail?
It was kind of applied to me when the internet first happened, AOL, and I had accrued bunches of spirits books and old liquor and stuff like this, just from a collector's mentality, and somebody said, "Man, you're here answering all these questions. You should really have a better name, Dr. Cocktail."
What kind of questions were people asking about cocktails?
Oh, they'd be asking shaken versus stirred. It's sort of the eternal questions, or they'd be asking, how does liquor keep in a bottle? Does liquor age in the bottle? Is there a way it goes bad?
Here's a question, Ted. I've got a question for you. What bourbon is best with what breakfast cereal?
You know, I'm in New Orleans, and somebody's drinking a bourbon mint julep somewhere in the city right now.
You know that is so right. But Ted, what am I going to learn going into a museum that I wouldn't know going into a bar anywhere?
Probably just how old the cocktail is. Hmm. And I quiz people on this all the time, and it's the rare person who gets this right.
All right, quiz us.
Okay. Quiz you? Who was president when the cocktail was founded? When the cocktail
George
first
Washington.
See, listen to you. You're too early. You tried for that. Thomas Jefferson.
I was close.
Yes, yes. And the fact
King Tut. I bet it's King Tut.
Sorry, that was disruptive. That was disruptive.
Yes. Anyway.
All right, so cocktails are old. Yes. Some cocktails are actually initiated by spirit manufacturers versus the mint julep, which comes from the people themselves. So how do you distinguish between names of cocktails?
Names of cocktails go totally crazy, obviously. But the ones initiated by spirits manufacturers, basically, and I'm going to say this straight out, even though many of the people who help support our museum are spirits manufacturers. Most of the cocktails initiated by spirits manufacturers are not good. In fact, they're horrible. They tend to emphasize the spirit, but because they're being done for a mass audience, they add a lot of sweet stuff to it. So imagine some of the spirit, a fruity liqueur, some sort of fruit juice, They're terrible. I mean, the best cocktails are initiated mainly by bartenders.
All right, give us a quick list, and then we got to go, because I guess we've got to have our cocktails this morning. Go ahead, Dr. Hay.
Okay. Quick list of cocktails?
Of your favorite.
Of my favorites?
The Hope Diamond of cocktails. Come on, buddy.
Okay, man. The Blinker, that would be rye whiskey, lemon juice, and raspberry syrup.
All right, well, that's our takeaway then from the Cocktail Museum, which opens this week in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Dr. Cocktail Hay, thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 22nd, and we have headlines for you right now. Femi Okey's here. Femi?
Hello there to you. It's 12 minutes to the hour. Barack Obama is in Jordan for talks with King Abdullah. The ex-Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic, who's been on the run for the last 13 years, has been captured and has been ordered to a UN war crimes tribunal in The Hague. The private security firm Blackwater Worldwide says it's shifting focus away from private security contracts to focus on other military work. Apple shares have dropped despite strong iPhone sales. And a federal appeals court has thrown out an indecency fine against CBS Television for the 2004 Super Bowl halftime show Wardrobe Malfunction. And that's a look at your international and domestic headlines.
You know, this just in, Wachovia announced an $8.66 billion loss, and the markets are poised to go downward at the open this morning. Just a little detail there.
Right. Thanks, Sean.
There's been lots of concerns about Wachovia this week. Not good news for them. And whatever ills are affecting the country, the mortgage crisis for one. Somehow it always seems to be that much worse in Florida. Investigative reporter Jack Dolan and two other reporters have discovered that in the midst of all of this subprime mortgage housing and other issues related to that market, that struggling market, they discovered that thousands of convicted felons walked right out of prison and into the housing market. What? As mortgage brokers and loan officers over the last 7 years, scamming Floridians out of millions of dollars. Jack Dolan joins us now. Good morning, Jack.
Hi, how are you doing?
Is this for real?
Yeah, sadly it is. It turns out that, you know, the Florida mortgage industry regulators, they do perform a criminal background check, you know, when you apply to get a license to become a mortgage broker. But the statute that they use, they say it's discretionary. So even when they find out that you, say, robbed a bank or just walked out of federal prison for cocaine trafficking, they don't prevent you from getting a license. They just sort of note it in your record. And
so it's actually in the record.
In a lot of cases, it is. But one of the things we found was that they check, you know, essentially the Florida State Police's database, but they don't check or have not been checking for years federal crimes. So if you were convicted in federal court, which is where a lot of, you know, serious white-collar crime and drug cases get prosecuted, they don't know.
So you hear all the time, bad credit, no problem. In this particular case, it's a federal felony, no problem. You can be a loan officer. What does this mean for consumers? I mean, if you were facing a loan officer who had a federal conviction, what kind of different treatment would you get based on your investigation?
Well, what we found was a lot of these guys, there's a particularly mean-spirited crime that happened a lot down here. What they would do is go into poor neighborhoods and say, look, your house is sort of falling down. Maybe you've had hurricane damage. We will get you a loan. Nobody else can. We will. We'll manage it. And we'll use the loan proceeds to fix up your house. When in fact what they did was they lied on the loan application to make these, you know, poor, often disabled people look like they had jobs and that they were young, get big loans and then steal the money.
So it's straight fraud.
Absolutely.
And was this done on an individual basis? Did individual convicted criminals come up with this idea, or were there rings of people who were targeting just those most vulnerable to these scams?
Oh, there were definitely rings. We highlighted a case of one guy who walked out of federal prison, actually disclosed on his application that he had been convicted of cocaine possession, sent a letter from his mom as a recommendation. And, you know, he was actually put on a kind of probation, but he was allowed to choose his own probation officer. So he chose a guy he met in federal prison. And he went to work for one fella in Tampa. He and the guy he met in prison went to work for one fella in Tampa who was doing this scam. Then they branched out on their own and started a whole string of companies on the west coast of Florida to do the same thing. And they eventually, you know, a whole group of these guys pled guilty to racketeering charges. But
the parole program itself enabled the entire scam.
Oh, it's a spectacular, spectacular breakdown. And
it's like straight out of a Carl Hyacinth book.
Straight out.
I sit next to Carl's son in the newsroom, and we were just, you know, laughing darkly about the whole, about the parallels.
Or Leonard, even. So essentially, are we talking about a colossal failure on several levels? On the regulators who regulate mortgages and that manner of business, and then on the second hand is the criminal justice system in the state of Florida not monitoring what these men and women were up to?
Well, you know, I can't speak to what the criminal justice system did, but the regulators, it all does sort of circle back to them, because one of the things they also failed to do is every 2 years, you know, you have to renew your mortgage broker's license. And a lot of states around the country, New York is one of them, they rerun your background check when you renew. And we found, you know, countless cases where, say, somebody comes in with a relatively clean record. But we had a guy who pled guilty to a racketeering case. He had a boiler room, and he sold $12 million in stock in a company that doesn't exist to elderly Floridians. On the day, or 5 days before he went to federal prison for that, he got a note from the mortgage regulator saying, you know, boy, it would actually be a crime if you failed to renew your license and continued to work. So he paid him. They renewed his license. He went to federal prison, and then he renewed his license again from federal prison.
Jack, I can't almost believe what you're saying. And not only can I not believe the individual instances, but the real problem here seems that it went on for years. They are not isolated incidents. How did this, all of everything you've just described, manage to escape anyone in any position of power and oversight for 7 years?
Well, when I was interviewing the number two in charge of the regulatory agency last week, he told me essentially that he has spent his life regulating banks, and he goes to meetings with people in silk suits, and that this particular end of the industry is guys in polyester suits, and that they just hadn't been paying that much attention.
Yeah, nobody wears polyester suits down in Florida, that's for sure. Really hard to find those guys. I guess, you know, this is really a part of a pattern in South Florida and broadly in the United States of an entire industry asleep at the switch in a time where money was really easy and credit was just extremely available and everybody was looking the other way. What's been the impact on real estate prices in South Florida just from this particular scandal? Any way to judge?
Probably impossible to judge yet. We were of the thousands of people we found who had criminal records. We found, you know, a couple dozen of them who have gone on to so far plead guilty to $85 million worth of mortgage fraud.
And that's just several dozen out of thousands. How many people would you consider victims in this?
Well, we were able to, you know, isolate and interview dozens. There were 30 in that case out of Tampa alone.
Wow.
So, you know, there are a lot of people who are suffering very badly.
And federal lawmakers are now asking question, what's the next step here as this onion, the peels, just seem to come off one at a time? What's next?
Well, there is federal legislation pending. The Big Housing Rescue Bill includes a provision that would ban felons from having broker's licenses for at least 7 years. It would also close the gap we wrote about on Monday that you know, you can even sell mortgages in Florida with no licensing at all, no background check, if you simply work for somebody else and are called a loan originator. So if that federal legislation passed, that would be a big step.
You know, Jack, I've got a personal question for you here.
Sure.
I mean, you're a journalist. I mean, you know, I think you're a pretty responsible guy, and you've certainly done a bang-up job on this story. But in any of your investigating, did you think, you know, maybe I should get out of journalism? I'm in the wrong business here.
Constantly. We kept looking at each other and saying, we are such, you know, schmendricks.
Yeah, but Jack, you're also free. Jack Dolan, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Jack Dolan, investigative reporter from the Miami Herald, with a major expose on convicted prisoners becoming part of the mortgage banking world.
If you've got a subprime scam story, you can reach us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. You can sign up for our weekly email newsletter, and it's all at www.thetakeaway.org.
If you missed anything on today's program, you can catch up on iTunes and Friend Feed. Do you know what Friend Feed
is? I think that's the takeaway for today.
What, Friend Feed?
We looked at each other and said, we're just a couple of schmendricks. That's the takeaway line. We looked at each other and said, we're schmendricks. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adoree Doge.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway